What's up, guys? Welcome to the first ever 10th episode of the Kinda Funny Games cast. As always, I'm Tim Geddes.
What's so upsetting is that people like it.
I know.
Like, I yell at you every week about this first ever crap, and everyone's like, no, let him do it.
No, it's pretty good.
Yeah, so there you go. I'm Tim Geddes. With me, the coolest dudes in video games, Colin Moriarty and Greg Miller.
Thanks. I don't know if that's true, but I appreciate it.
It is true. It's a fact. I actually did scientific research.
Oh, good.
I'm not a scientist. I know that.
You printed it in a peer-reviewed journal?
Yes.
You understand the scientific method, though.
Uh-huh. There's hypotheses and conclusions.
Objectively provable. Mm-hmm. That's all that matters.
And all the way from far away, we got Keza McDonald here.
What up?
You might know her. She was a former
co-worker.
We all worked together back at IGN.
Yep.
But it was like, we didn't work together. We weren't in the same building.
I was separated by an ocean.
Yes,
from
there was a big ocean.
But then a continent.
What do you mean, you people? What are you saying about Americans?
That was brilliant.
We all had our moments, though. Like, I'm sure you guys got to work with her a bit more than I did. But we had our moments. I don't know if you remember.
I sure do.
But at E3 2012? 13?
Yeah, that would have been
one
right.
One of those. We did some conversations. We talked Witcher.
We chatted.
It was Witcher 2 or 3. I don't know. It was
three
something.
At that point?
Probably
oh, man.
Three.
All the E3s have started to blend. I've done, I don't know what, 8 of them now, and they've all just started to blend to one just mass of tiredness.
Yeah, one and ball of misery.
Overhyped video games.
And dubstep. So much dubstep.
And things that will be delayed.
I always think about the poor people who are on the floor at E3 and who have to stay in a booth whilst the same Just Dance song plays continuously for 4 days. It must be the worst.
Speaking of that, a couple years ago, Call Me Maybe, when it first came out, that was like the biggest deal.
Yeah.
Was that Call Me Maybe was just playing on repeat at the damn Just Dance thing.
Yeah.
Carly Rae Jepsen's new song came out last night.
This has
nothing to do with video games unless you know.
Unless
maybe,
it's in Just Dance.
It will be in Just Dance. Have you guys heard it?
No.
Oh, I really, really, really like it.
Good.
Good. Yeah. That's great to
That's
know.
Good news.
Yeah. So that was
the booth I always felt bad. It was the last year and for the entire year of conventions when the DuckTales booth was there.
Oh, no.
Because, like, you'd walk by the DuckTales booth where they were making people sing in the thing, and it'd be like, oh, that's awesome. But then to be a booth next to that for, like, 3 days straight up.
Every day.
And everybody freaking out. Yeah. And like, oh, my God.
Oh, Jesus.
You would hate that so much.
It's just like with Rockman 1 when I came up and I was like, oh, man, thanks, guys. I can't wait to demo. I'm like, oh, Saying Ain't So. And they're like, you are not fucking playing Saying Ain't So.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You are not allowed to play that.
Yeah.
We will blow our brains out.
Oh, God.
Keza, I like your shirt a lot.
Thank you very much.
It's very classy.
Pokemans?
Official Kanto gym leader.
Status
Kanto? Kanto? I don't know how to say it.
Kanto, I guess.
Kanto, I used to call it.
Yeah. Kanto? Yeah.
If you're being Japanese about
it. It's pretty awesome. So, where are we, Greg?
Oh, right now, everybody. If you're watching the video. If you're listening to MP3, it sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
If you just think we're at the house, it's great. We're not at the house.
Mm-mm.
We are broadcasting and recording this at Patreon.com. Of course, Patreon.com is what changed our lives and allowed us to get money from you to quit our jobs to start all this crazy business stuff
Woo!
We do. It's kind of funny.
Yeah!
Thank you very much
for your support. They were nice enough, Patreon, to
give
us
to the Death Star.
Put us in the Death Star here.
It is very strange.
It is, right? Colin's been flipping switches all day.
Mm-hmm. I can't figure out if any of it's real switches or are
it's
they
all.
Okay,
it's all held together with duct tape. We're in their room here podcasting, doing right now. But what's happening, which is weird, is that we are recording this live while it's being broadcasted to Twitch. We've been doing this stream Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday from 11 to 5. GDC devs coming in, GDC friends coming in, showing games, talking games. And part of that was yesterday doing Game Over Greggy show with Harley, and then today doing the Gamescast. So Twitch people are watching right now. We're not in the chat like we usually are because we're focusing on making the show as normally it happens.
Mm-hmm. And as it normally happens, this is a show where we get together and we talk about video games, whatever the hell we want to talk about video games, four topics broken out over the week over on youtube.com/kindoffunnygames. Then on Friday, you can get the new episode over at patreon.com/kindoffunnygames, which is where we are. We are actually in that website right now.
Yep.
This is the website.
Yeah,
that's why it looks
like this is what the internet
that's
looks
the
like
yeah.
in real
so
life.
So it's pretty cool. Or then you can just get last week's episode over on iTunes or SoundCloud or like PodTrack.
So you can get
the
newest thing early or you can wait and get it all for free.
Yeah, and it's great. And there's your rigmarole. But on to some real shit right now.
Some real shit.
Right now this is the Game Developers Conference, GDC.
Right.
It's a couple blocks away from here. Let me ask you guys a question. Who the hell cares about GDC?
You're a piece of shit.
Game developers?
I care about it.
I presume?
Yeah. See, and I ask this because I am, you know, I'm in the game industry in many ways. But I'm a video guy. Like, completely video guy. I play games, care about stuff. I love game announcements. E3 is, like, my favorite week of the year. I know Colin hates it.
Yeah, E3 is like a ball of complete
misery.
It's
great if you don't go.
Yeah, when you cover it in a traditional way, which we will not be doing anymore, which is awesome.
This is weird, by the way, because the last time we were all together, we were all at IGN, and now none of us are.
Yeah,
exactly.
Which is...
It is. Oh, yeah, we didn't even get to that. Where are you now?
Oh, yeah, I run Kotaku in the UK now.
Very fun.
Yeah, haven't done IGN in the UK, and I do Kotaku. It's fun.
But yeah, I just don't like... E3's fun to watch. E3 is not fun to work. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And, so yeah, we won't be doing that anymore, so I don't have to be... I get to go to E3 for the first time this year. This will be my 10th, I think, and just be happy.
But, you know, I feel like to a lot of gamers, and I know for me, that growing up, E3 was like this thing you look forward to all year.
Right.
It's just like there's two times of the year for gamers that are like the big things. There's E3, which announces the games. Then there's November, December, when you're like, holy shit, how am I going to buy all these games? And there's E3, and then there's like Gamescom, there's all these other ones where there's announcements happening and you're excited. And then there's GDC, which I always wanted to be excited about because I'm from San Francisco, and it would happen, I'm like, nothing's happening here. This is
a business
boring
conference, isn't it? It's a place for people to come and meet people who can help them with their business, essentially.
Yeah.
And you know, the weird thing was, when I was growing up reading magazines, you know, you just run out the door when the post E3 magazine deadlines would happen, you'd just be like, ah, just grabbing everything off the shelves, consuming it all. And now, because of the internet, it's just a very different experience. You know, you don't have to wait for all the information to happen. It's just all happening all the time.
Right.
And so in that magazine era, GDC wasn't really a it was a game developers conference. It was where people went to do business stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And now, because of the internet, it's become this thing that people cover. And it never really was that interesting to begin with, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, there's two different tracks to the question, I think. And like, why GDC matters and is exciting to a fan versus why GDC is exciting to us, right? Because we're lucky enough to be here. We get to go out and see our friends. We get to go to parties with our friends, catch up with developer friends. These people we haven't seen in forever, right? As a fan, I think the crossover is what's so exciting is... This is the place. This is E3 with all the bullshit stripped away. This is the core of why everybody does what they do. They come here and do this and talk to each other and learn from each other because they love games.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was the thing when I first started covering it. You go to these panels and I would gloss over because they're talking about shaders and how many of the strings that they had to connect to. And you're like, I don't even know what the hell you're saying. I'm only here to see if you're going to slip up and mention Killzone 4. You know what I mean? Or something like, well, you know what I mean? That's what I'm here
for. That's very honest.
And that's what I mean, that's what we were sent out to panels to do. And that's why panels have become less important. And now it's stuff like this where hey, a developer will come in and show you your game and catch you up on that. But it's... You know, when people talk about indies and how they work together and they do this and da-da-da, and, like, you know, the games are, there's crossover between their games and stuff, I always think back to the fact that, you know, every GDC I've ever been to has been, hey, we are so-and-so, we had this super successful game, let me take you behind the curtain now and show you how we did that. You know what I mean? The games industry from... When we talk about the games industry, you get, oh, I'm an Xbox fan. Well, I'm a PlayStation fan. There's all these battle lines drawn. And developers don't give a shit about any of that. Developers want every developer's game to be awesome, to support the industry, go. Even if they have an exclusive agreement with one of the companies, you talk to them off the record, they're usually like, well, I wish we were on everything.
Yeah, of course.
I want everyone to play
People
our
want
game.
Everyone to play their video game.
Yeah, so you get here and it's all unbridled excitement and passion for the future and the serious conversations we always say we don't get, right? Of like, what is the role of a female protagonist and how is this playing? And da, da, da. Those are the things that are happening right now over beers in conference rooms. People are... I was talking to somebody last night and I was saying, what's so exciting in that room next door, which was the Indie Open House, the Indie Mixer thing they do every year at IGN, was the fact that right now someone's new favorite game is in there. You know what I mean? You don't know it at home yet watching this video, but something over there, people are playing for the first time, and it's gonna blow your fucking mind in a little bit. That's awesome.
So how important do you think that GDC is to the indie developers? Because I feel like over the last couple of years...
I think hugely, because there's so much like sharing of skills. And, you know, not just technical skills, but just the kind of the art of making games as well as the technical stuff and as well as the business. Like, I can't tell you how many indie developers I've met who cannot sell their game for shit, you know. And this is where they meet somebody who can help them with that, you know. And, you know, ultimately you need, most of the time, unless you've got like Mike Bithell who did Thomas Was Alone.
Yeah.
Unless you've got someone like him, you need someone to sell your game for you. Like, you need a business partner to sort of do all the complicated, like the contractual stuff and getting it onto the, you know, the Wii U store or wherever you want it to be. You need someone to do that for you. And that's where that very vital work is done. So I think it is hugely important.
Yeah, I think that, you know, GDC is special because I think a lot of people think about creating video games as a skill. And it's really not. The skill is the final product is the amalgamation of many different skills, whether it's coding or art or design, which I think is one of the major understated things about games. Like, there are people that design the games. And I think we often they don't necessarily have practical coding skills, or they just put things in you know, into really rudimentary programs, which then help the artists and the programmers and stuff. So I think that, like, this is a way to, for everyone to synthesize their knowledge and their lack of knowledge of certain things. And I agree with Kezo, like, there's a lot of business done at GDC, and business is done at E3. I think there's a lot of business done at Gamescom, but
they're more consumer focused.
Exactly,
and that's a horrible word. I'm so sorry. Ew. They're more like outward facing.
No, exactly. And you like, there
don't
are
dress it up. People, we know
there
now.
there's business deals being done there, but I think GDC is really all about that. Like, GDC is not for, it's really not for gamers.
Yeah,
you know, and I think that's what's so interesting about it. You know, Keza and I are both really into storytelling and into writing long form articles and really delving deep into things. And I think that, so for people like us, I think GDC is really special because of the stories you hear, and even a lot of the off the record stuff you hear. Like, there's a lot of fascinating stuff happening this week, every week, or every year in San Francisco. So GDC is actually my favorite show. And I think because it is so different, because it is so not for the consumer, it is so for everyone heightening their art and learning from each other and just seeing, like, we had the guys from Drinkbox here before, and before that we had Nathan from Cappy, and they know each other, and they work together in Toronto, but they were mingling in the Patreon right. lobby, talking about how they never see each other in Toronto, and they see each other more at these kinds of shows, and they catch up, and they're gonna go get dinner at some point, and all, you know, like, that stuff's good. That's good yeah. stuff, and it's a more human element.
The question you're asking, you know, how important is it to the indie developer? I think it's incredibly important, no matter what part of the scale, like how long you've been doing it, right? If you're brand new, it's about coming here and learning. If you're in the middle, it's about making connections, right? Last night, it was just amazing. I always. The best part of what we do outside of interacting with our community, maybe I'm thinking more of when we're at IGN, the best part we do, obviously, is getting to hang out and talk yeah. video games with our best friends every day. But one of the coolest things I get to do is be a conduit between people I think already know each other and don't, right? Like, I was talking to a developer who remained nameless last night, who's independent. She's trying to get her game out there. I'm having a conversation, and then Gio from PlayStation walked up, and I was like, oh, do you guys know each other? And she's like, no. And I'm like, oh, she would love to have her game on the PlayStation platform. He's like, oh, cool. And gives her a card. Like, that's yeah. such an easy connection. We take it for granted that we – and, like, people were tweeting at me angrily, right, of, like, you know, on Colin and Greg this week, we've been – or even, I guess, last week with Ryan Payton, tweeting out at, like, Adam Boys and Geo and saying, like, hey, get this game on PlayStation. And then people are like, well, why don't you try to get it on Xbox? And it's like, well, I don't have that kind of relationship with Xbox. I don't know the right people to go to at Xbox, right? Like, Phil Spencer, I don't know if he wants me bugging him with all these different games. But this is, like, that situation of, like, I know PlayStation so well that I know they are looking for independent developers. But if you're an independent developer who's put all your money in to get to San Francisco, do you know how to connect those dots? And that's awesome to be able to be a part of it and see that and hope something happens.
Absolutely.
So taking a step back, what is GDC? Like, for the people at home that don't know, because I remember when I was younger, I just had no idea what it was, because I imagined it was just like E3 was. You see the pictures in the magazines of E3, and you're like, oh, yeah, there's like these crazy booths and all this stuff. But like, so what exactly does the conference consist of?
It's a business summit. So you have people who sit in rooms who talk and have a PowerPoint presentation about what they've done with their animation, or like a cool thing they discovered when they were doing user testing in their latest game, or something like that. That's usually quite like nitty gritty development stuff. And then a lot of people sit and watch. And so there are, you know, 10, 20 of these panels going on at any one time. And you kind of work through the day as a developer, or, you know, someone attending, you work through the day and you pick stuff that you think looks interesting or sounds interesting, and you go along and have a little listen. I thought the post-morts, as they call them, are some of the most interesting ones, which is when a developer, their game probably released last year, and they're like, here is the whole process and what we learned from releasing Divinity Original Sin, or from releasing Shenmue. That was a great one a few years back. And the great thing about GDC now is that you can watch all of it. It's all on the vault online, and you can just watch these talks. So if you just happen to be really interested in, I don't know, as a particular developer, or Shenmue or whatever, you can just watch, you know, an hour of a guy talking about what it was like to make it and release it. And I think that's great. We never used to be able to do that.
No,
I would have ate that up when I was a teenager.
Sure. Yeah. To have that insight, right? To be able to hear these people talk about what they actually go through.
Yeah. I think there's a lot. I think something like GDC breeds a lot more openness, even if it's really not meant for major consumption or mainstream consumption. Because, yeah, it is. There are all these panels, but like, and the panels are great and are fascinating. I've been to so many great panels. I wish I could actually go to GDC this year, but, you know, we have our passes. We're just not going to be able to do anything with them. But the show floor is funny, too, to me, because it is not. PlayStation has like their games out there and stuff, but it's really different in the sense that there's guys in a booth trying to sell their middleware, and there's a dude giving like his own PowerPoint presentation with some benches in front of it about this engine that he's trying to sell, and there's this other person, you know, trying to find indie developers to bring for ID at Xbox, and they're like, it is a show floor, but it is like the antithesis of E3 show floor, because it is not for anyone to buy shit. It is actually for the developer to sell shit to, you know, or for someone to buy an engine, or for someone to buy, you know, or to like communicate to, with an artist where they need some help on some art. Yeah. Like it's just its own different kind of show. So I understand why some people aren't interested in it. And I also understand why there's some frustration that more news doesn't come out of it. Mm-hmm. I think Project Morpheus was probably the biggest piece of news that has come out of GDC in years. But
PlayStation Move was announced here, Colin.
Yeah.
It kind of changed everything.
That did change everything. So I understand that level, but like when you're there and you're on the ground, it is fascinating. I agree with Keza again, like the vault is really super valuable. If you're into not necessarily only games, but into the skill and the art of making a game and what goes into it. I've been to so many weird panels. I've walked out of many panels at GDC too because I'm like, this is way over my head. Yep, like, I have no idea what the hell you're talking about.
They're literally showing lines of code and you're like, all right, nice.
Telltale did one a few years ago or a couple years ago about The Walking Dead Season 1 about storytelling and how they were learning what people were doing based on the decisions they were making. There's like really interesting stuff that might not fit into a 10-minute presentation at E3 or might not fit neatly into a 5-minute documentary style video that goes on IGN or something like that. But it's great for 90 minutes in front of a bunch of your fellow developers. You know, this is what we learned from the way people play our game, and here's how it can help you. And I think that's what's really cool is that everyone wants to help each other.
Yep. There's something you said earlier about how games are, you know, a conflagration of art, music, design, all these different... That's one of the things that makes games so interesting for me, is that there's all these different elements of skill involved in the creation of a game, you know, from architecture to music to writing, you know, to narrative design, all this kind of stuff, and everybody has to be good at what they do. But then the challenge of making games, and this is what you hear over and over again at GDC or anywhere where developers talk, is that integrating those things with each other, getting them to mesh, is so hard, because like the writer will write something great, but then that just won't work with what the programmer needs to do in this scenario, and they end up cutting like half of the story, and then everything has to be rewritten in 2 months. And a lot of the time when you play a game and you think, that's a stupid fucking plot twist, what the hell is that? Nobody wanted to do it, you know. It's just something that had to be done in order to make the game work together. And I think that you get a lot of insight into there was something on Kotaku a couple of weeks ago about like things I didn't understand about game development until I did it, which is from a guy who used to work for Anthony, who used to work for Destructoid and now works for Gearbox.
And he just left Gearbox.
Oh, has he?
That was his whole thing of like, this is like my look back on what I didn't understand.
Well, that was super interesting because he was like, I used to be so mean. I used to be like, what the fuck? This is so stupid. Are the people who designed Assassin's Creed or whatever complete idiots? And then obviously the experience of making a game and seeing how hard it is to make all these things work together really made him think, you know, made him understand why sometimes when you play a game, there's some really stupid decision.
Sure.
Suddenly it's like, okay. Or you have something that, because most games aren't fun until they're like 80, 90% finished. Which is crazy. Like you see a game and it just doesn't work at all, and then 4 months before they have to ship it, suddenly it's fun.
Yeah.
And I have sympathy for that, because sometimes you play a game and there's an idea in it that doesn't work and you're like, okay, well they didn't know it wasn't going to work. Like they thought
by
it would work.
By the time they got to the point of like, it's implemented, let's play with it, you come back the next day, you're like, it didn't work.
Yeah.
What do we do?
Yeah.
Do you guys have any standout moments from any GDCs that you'll never forget?
Yeah, I mean, I do in the sense that, you know, I just like, again, all of these, the one thing that sticks out to me was the history of GDC panel that I think this was a long time ago. It's probably like 2010 maybe. They did, like, the guys that were at the original Game Developer Conference were there, a few of them. The original Game Developer Conference was, I think, like 25 or 30 people. And it was like it was in the 80s or like late 80s, maybe. I don't remember the exact history, but I remember just sitting there. It was a really long panel. I want to say it was like maybe even 2 hours. And they were going through like all of the history and how it's grown and how important it's become to kind of be this symbiotic thing where like one person helps another and stuff like that. And it was actually quite enlightening and quite uplifting that something so small and so quaint has turned into this thing where this is GDC prime, as it were, but there are GDCs around the world and different kinds of similar GDC style conferences, all of it as a result of some of these guys kind of just getting together by themselves on their own, you know, on their own accord to talk about game development. Not even to talk about games, not even to talk about the history of games or the art of games, but just about making games. Mm-hmm. And I think that sticks out to me. I still remember that panel pretty well. Yeah.
For me, there was a great, it's the panels and the discussions, right? As a fan, there was a panel that Jens Andersen did about DC Universe Online, and it was legit fascinating, not just because I'm a huge DC Online fanboy, but it was about how they are telling their story and how they're doing DLC, and like he showed like their office and their like note cards connected like any, you know, like when you're laying out a show or whatever, but then how it like would piggyback to, it's going to be this DLC, which is a year and a half. It was like this really fascinating thing of like strings, like connecting everything of what they're doing. And then there was another great one that I thought was really cool to see from Eric Brudvig back when he was at EDAR, and he talked about reviews and how much reviews actually matter and what that actually means. And he was like, you know, a bad review is better than no review. You want if you get reviewed, that's, you know, you want that because it sticks in people's mind, even to the point of like, well, I heard it wasn't that great.
That developer did that interesting thing. It wasn't so good, but I wonder what they'll do next.
Exactly. There's some cachet to it. There's that. And then, of course, yeah, the PlayStation Move reveal. Right. I infamously wrote, I was just like, I'm sick to my stomach. Like, I don't know what they're doing. Why are they doing this?
This is actually my first GDC.
No shit.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously, IGN was based in San Francisco, so there was no point in flying me over from, you know, Britain to go. But I do have a great secondhand story. Mm. Disclaimer, I wasn't there, blah, blah. But apparently, do you remember who Jay Allard was? He was the head of Xbox, the first Xbox, right? And he was this dude, and he was like a tubby, bearded guy who... Someone somewhere at Microsoft put him through this like makeover image change thing, and he became the face of Xbox, and he was just this like tall, skinny, bald dude with like a leather jacket who always wore the same clothes, and he had an earring and everything, and he was just like, and I remember when they announced the Xbox 360, I remember watching the little video that they did, and he was the guy being like, so we just took the Xbox and we goosed it and we tricked it and we had this concave gesture, and he was just that guy, you know?
Yeah.
And apparently at GDC shortly after the Xbox launch, he was in a bar drunk off his ass on like 6 or 7 cocktails, and every journalist who walked past, he's like, come sit down with me, man, come sit down, and just like told all this unbelievable stuff about the first years of Xbox, just, and that's that. I like that story because that happens a lot at GDC, like you end up talking to somebody and they're telling you all this stuff that you would never know. There's no way you're ever going to get it from an interview or from anything official, and you just learn, you know, these high profile games, they're like, that development was fucked up, let me tell you an amazing story about it.
That's the thing. It seems like kind of like a big party for a bunch, you were saying earlier, like friends you don't see for that long, like as game journalists you guys have worked with these developers for years, and so now it's like you all get to come together and party and talk about everything that you couldn't talk about at the time.
Well, that's always the story, right? Everybody makes the joke, the horror, the totally dark joke, but if you dropped a bomb on the W at like 2 a.m. on any GDC night, you'd wipe out like the entire video. We'd be set back 20 years because everyone's there. Like, everyone is there. No, don't do that if you're like VR games.
Jesus God.
No, it's true. Yeah, I mean, I've learned, I think, more off the record stuff at GDC than anywhere else. And like, for all the off the record stuff we know and we've learned over the years, whatever, just fascinating stories. I'm just a consumer of good stories, even if I can't tell them to my readers. I know a lot of good stories, and I think many of them. A majority of it has been, you know, at something like GDC. You know? So, because everyone is a little more open. There's a lot of trust, I think, at GDC. And I think it does show the best parts of the game industry. And I think that's awesome, too. Something like Gamescom shows, I think, the worst part of the game industry, which is loud and obnoxious and
seething,
hype and all these kinds of things.
Seething masses of people.
Yeah, and just, you know, and I think that I'm excited about some of those games, but, like, I don't like the way it's displayed. I don't like the show it's become, you know, and I'm not pointing only at Gamescom, but everything like it, where even TGS or something like that, it's just like it's a whole thing, you know. GDC is just what it is. It's not about loud music. It's not about pretty graphics necessarily. It's not about success. You know, it's not about
booth babes. It's not about costume dudes. It's not about, it's like everything's stripped away. Like,
it's, you know, nice to have that soft band at E3 now. Like the last few years, I've noticed a massive like drop off in the number of like.
Yeah, the increasing
clad
clothing.
Models. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the correlation is like.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's what GDC is.
Do you care about it now?
I mean, I understand its importance now. And it's one of those things where doing this has been really eye-opening to me because I've been at IGN, and whenever it's GDC, it was definitely always a thing like where I was like, ugh. Like, oh, I need to go to this dumb appointment with somebody and like bring a camera, lug all this equipment, and it's like, for what? You know, and nothing would ever come out of it. But then all of a sudden, something would. Like, I remember one time I was at a panel with Notch, and he dropped something about Minecraft, and I was like, oh shit, and the video ended up getting like 300,000 views. And I was just like, okay, that was worth it. But then there's 10 other things where I'm just like, ugh, I hate this so much. But here, this is different. Like, we've been bringing in all these guys and playing these games, and it's just like, hey, here are fun games.
Yeah, you finally get to see it from our perspective.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Thinking back to the GDCs and like great memories, one I would be remiss not to tell is when David Cage showed up and showed the Kara demo.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? And then I remember afterwards I got like 15 or 30 minutes with him in like one of the side rooms of GDC with a cup of coffee. And we just sat there and shot the shit about games and everything else. And I was such a heavy Rain fan and all this different stuff. Like, that is awesome to be able to sit there and have that just kind of openness with developers. It's a great time to be
real around. Conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's nice.
It is very
not
cool.
Where they
no,
bullet
with
points.
No PR people in the way.
Exactly.
All right, guys. Next topic. Metal Gear Solid 5 finally got a release date. September 1st, 2015. Now we've heard about
this
game.
We're not supposed to know that, are we? What?
But we do.
But we
thanks, NeoGAF.
Yeah.
And IGN's Spanish site or whatever the hell it was.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell.
Things happen.
Yeah, it happens.
It's bad. So, anyway, September 1st. That's a really interesting release date, in my opinion, because it's earlier than the holiday rush.
Sure.
And it's not the week of E3, which for some reason games like to do every once in a while when it's big games.
Or
The
Last of Us.
So I want to talk to you guys about release dates, their importance. How important is a worldwide day and date release date? How important is the season that you're releasing your game? Is there a strategy to releasing different games at different times? What do you think?
How important is worldwide?
So important, guys. No, I spent all of my childhood and teenage years being irritated by arbitrary 3-month waits for video games in Europe. And the reasons for that were like localization stuff for all the European nations. And, you know, especially Nintendo, it would be freaking years sometimes before. And then sometimes we would just never get the game. And it would be out in America and it would be out in Japan. We'd just never get it here. Now, it's very different because sometimes we now get games earlier in Europe than everywhere else. And I don't know why this has happened. But things like, especially Nintendo, again, weirdly, they now release stuff here, you know, 2 or 3 weeks before the States. And I think that it's stupid now to not have a worldwide release date. We have digital distribution.
Right.
There is no valid reason for not having a worldwide release date. If you haven't translated it into all the right languages, then you've fucked up. You've badly managed your production at some point.
Like, especially when you're talking about digital and just the world we live in today, right? Yeah. Like Twitter, like trending on Twitter isn't limited to one.
I mean,
you can break it down that way, but usually you want to have an impact and be everywhere, be huge.
And, you know, Dying Light was a recent strange thing where basically they only had a physical release in America, but in Europe we didn't have physical discs, but we had the digital version. So it was technically released and it did really well in the charts. And then they had a physical version released last Friday, so like a month on. And again, I think that was just probably the production of the discs went wrong or something. But again, that doesn't happen now. You don't need to produce discs most of the time. And you have this really stupid thing that happens sometimes where things come out in America on Tuesdays, right? In Europe, usually Fridays. So there's usually like a 2 or 3 day gap in the retail. But then sometimes on Steam, it'll be like, oh, the new, I don't know, Civilization is out, but you have to wait 3 days, even though it's right there.
Right.
See, that's dumb.
It's really dumb.
I never understood that.
That was the problem that we were having here in the States for a while, where things came out, you know, time zones, right? Like, everybody in New York gets it at 9, but then they'd, well, we're going to release it at 3 a.m. if you want the digital version. And he's like, what the hell are you doing for New York time? And New York people would get all mad about it, and they'd be always with this, with and the other. With Watch and the other.
Oh, with Watch and Whistle.
But now they're getting better about that, too. PlayStation switched off that, it looks like, finally.
Yeah, I think that, well, first of all, per Metal Gear Solid 5, I think it's an ingenious time to release the game. I don't think they realize that Mad Max is also coming out that same day. So that's going to be. That's going to be interesting.
Max.
Well, Mad Max is going to be huge. So it's not going to be as Metal Gear, but that's a triple A game. I mean, I'm just saying that I think that they probably thought the schedule was going to be more clear than it is.
Do you think Mad Max is going to be a triple A game?
It's an Avalanche game. Yeah,
I mean, I'm just saying this is just going off Mad Max, where it's like, to me, that's just
isn't
like,
that like a, just a 30-year-old movie?
Yeah.
It,
well, I think they're redoing it, but I'm just basing it on the studio that's making it. Avalanche makes AAA games, so I don't think that they're making a, and it's been in development for a long time. So I'm just saying, like, right off the bat, I think it's a great time to release the game. I think that they thought it was going to be more clear than that. Mad Max is going to sell, release dates are essential, and finding the releases. We were talking this morning with Nathan from Cappy about the dice roll of identifying a date. You really don't know when games are going to come out and who's going to be affected and what game you might have to go up against. And it's like a horrifying, it is actually, like, I think for a lot of developers, one of the most, and publishers, one of the most horrifying things.
Sure.
And you always feel so sorry when any developer has a release date and then some other big game is coming out that week and suddenly everyone's like, oh, we can't review it, sorry, we're all really busy on this, and then everyone doesn't buy it.
Yeah, exactly.
Just, it can really mess you up, right?
Which goes back to what Greg was saying about just the review itself being pertinent to, you know, even if it's a bad review
some
of making
press.
Some press for your game. Yeah, because I mean, think about how people dodge Call of Duty and think about how people dodged Grand Theft Auto 5. Like, it was the fucking plague.
Man.
You know what I mean? So, like, there's just certain bombs you drop. I don't think Metal Gear Solid is one of those bombs, but it's a good time for it. And I think what we were discussing earlier is that the paradigm of when games are coming out, when we expect big and good games are coming out, is shifting. I think that the holiday season is good and good games come out then, but that's when we expected a lot of our games, like the mass of those games come out. And I actually think now we're seeing games, some of them being released in summer. I think Metal Gear Solid is a cusp on a summer game, which is really kind of interesting. And then you're seeing a lot of stuff in the spring, as we're seeing right now, games that weren't ready for fall that are being pushed. I think that's spreading it out. I think the conventional wisdom that holiday drives sales is absolutely true, but I also think the conventional wisdom is overstated, that if you find the right place to release your game, that means more than anything. Dying Light is the perfect example.
That would have done nothing in November.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wrote. I wrote about it because I still freelance for IGN and I write a piece once a week over there. And I wrote about Dying Light. I'm like, Dying Light did 1.2 million copies in its first week. Dying Light in its lifetime, if it came out in November, would have done 1 million copies probably. Yeah. So it's like, that, because Dying Light was it, everyone paid attention to it and found out, oh, it's actually a really good game. Like, I had no expectations for that game at all, and I wouldn't have had time to play it in November. But I'm glad it came out when it did, because actually it's my favorite game of the year so far. Not that there's, you know, too much out there competing with it. So I think those things matter. I do think that, per Kez's point, there's some complicated marketing and publishing things that keep games from coming out worldwide around the same time. And you see it a lot with smaller Japanese developers, especially in publishers. Yeah. Like NIS and Atlas are often publishing each other's games in Europe and North America because there's just weird shit going on that I don't quite understand between all the territories.
Contractual bizarreness.
But it's not nearly as bad as the days you were talking about. I mean, growing up as a JRPG fan in the, you know, early 90s and mid 90s, and obviously in the even in the late 80s, it was common to wait 18 to 24 months to get a game from Japan, and you didn't know what you were going to get. I remember like Treasure Hunter G or whatever, like Bahamut Lagoon, all these like games that came out on Super Famicom that we were like, oh, we will eventually get these games, but they never came out. You know, because you were just, because there seemed to be no rhyme or reason as to why some of these games would come out and some of them wouldn't.
I went totally nuts when I lived in Japan in 2008-9, and when I moved there, I had all these memories from, you know, being a kid. I used to read this magazine called N64 Magazine. It was my favorite. And there was this guy called Will Overton who used to do all the import reviews, right? And I'd be flicking through this and it'd be like, Osumo 64, Mahjong Simulator, weird RPG that will never happen. I just remember like obsessing over these games. Like in my head, they must be the best games.
Because I can't play
because I could
this,
never so have them. And then when I moved to Japan, what I didn't realize is that over there, game retail goes back. Like you go into a game store and they've got ancient games. They've got stuff from the late 80s there. Like they've just got, you know, they'll have the wall of PlayStation 4 and then like upstairs they'll have buckets and buckets of N64 games and SNES games and NES games like way back and every format that's ever existed, PlayStation games, and most of them, you know, they'll have, there'll be some rare ones in like a box with like a special, like, you know, it's $100 or whatever.
Yeah.
And then there'll be just buckets of other ones.
Yeah.
And I, oh man, there was this
how
place.
How much money did you blow?
So much. But the thing was, all these N64 games, like Osumo 64, which apparently was an amazing multiplayer game, Super Bass Fishing, and all these just weird games that never came out, Darby Horse Racer, all these things I bought because they were like 100 yen each, which is like a dollar. And I ended up buying like 50 Japan only N64 games, and then I bought an actual N64 to play them. And every single time I'd get home to my dorm room, plug it in, and be like, and it would always be terrible. Every time it would be well, or like not great anyway.
Well, but I think Colin, when you're talking about the RPGs, I think that makes a little more sense, just because there's so much text and there's so much like things that need to be translated. And
there was
a
localization,
stuff.
But there's also weird things. One of the famous stories of the NES era with Squaresoft specifically was that Final Fantasy II, the real Final Fantasy II, not Final Fantasy IV. Which is Final Fantasy II in the States back in the day, was translated and done. And in fact, at CES that year, they had like pamphlets and a playable versions of the English version of Final Fantasy II, which then just never came out.
Couldn't happen.
So there was like, there was all sorts of, there's like all sorts of just weird shit going on back then.
Why, do you know why that happened?
No, I mean, it must have been a publishing. Like, I think that Squaresoft at that time was like, no one's going to buy an NES game. You know, because Super Nintendo would come out in late 91, and so they were looking at it then. But there was localization and translation issues too, but also I think them just kind of seeing the market grow.
You have to think really seriously about releasing a game physically back then. It would cost you a fortune to release a cart game, you know, into, and there was no, it is now, like, all the, you know, all these old Nintendo games that we never had, like Earthbound never came out in Europe, I don't think. Anyway, games like that, they just stick them on the eShop now, or whatever. And back then, though, you know, if you thought your game wasn't going to sell loads, you really couldn't manufacture all the cartridges. I mean, it would have bankrupted them probably.
Yeah, because I mean, that's a great point, because there was a lot of big problems. First of all, Nintendo stymied the entire cartridge industry intentionally. So you had to buy your cartridges directly from Nintendo, unless you were like Tengen and you wanted to like fuck around with them. And so you would get an allotment of cartridges, which you then had to pay ahead of time. And some publishers were bullish enough to, as we've talked about many times, make basically shadow publishers. So like Konami and Ultra were the same company, but they were, because you can only release 5 games a year on an NES, they would make 2 companies to release 10 games. But there were other publishers that were much more cautious. And actually, when I did the history of Naughty Dog at IGN, I was talking to, you know, the founders of Naughty Dog, and they would tell the story about when they made their first Genesis game, which is Rings of Power, which is an RPG, that they only could make like 100,000 copies of their game because there were no more cartridges to buy. And when the next allotment of cartridges came out, EA published the game and they're like, we only have X amount of cartridges and we're giving them to the sports guys, so we cannot make any more copies.
That's crazy.
Of you know, like, and that's
different
like
world.
Yeah, it's like, it's a totally different space, so things were just done differently then. But I think a lot of it maybe not necessarily had to do with just the market economics, but also translating a game is hard. A lot of the translations we got were terrible. I mean, you only see that when you see a retranslation of Final Fantasy VI or Final Fantasy Tactics or games like that. And then the process of getting them localize and then going through CERT again and all that kind of stuff? Is it worth the money? Is it worth the time? I think that JRPGs had such a long tail in the United States with Final Fantasy II, for instance, I don't think the proof was in the pudding yet. Mm-hmm. I think when you saw a game like Chrono Trigger, right before PS1 came out, I think that was the proof, which is why, like, during the PS1 era, we were getting like two good RPGs a year for 5 years. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that times had just changed at that point.
But you couldn't just throw something out there and see if it sold, you can do now. You know, you can put something on Steam and just be like, whoops, see if anyone wants it. Yeah, it's so much better. We get so many more games now. Mm-hmm. It really is so much better. Like the internet has completely revolutionized how games are played, mm-hmm. and how we can just have access to them. But on the other hand, like I had a friend who was extremely good at knowing about obscure as shit PS2 games, and he introduced me to a bunch of just completely weird things that were Japan only, and his entire world basically was learning about these games, and that's kind of gone now. His specialty is now gone. Mm-hmm. But, you know, things like Tulip, which I think actually came out in America weirdly, but it was a kind of isometric RPG where you're a little guy in a village and you want to kiss a girl that you like, so you have to work your way up to her by kissing all the other people in the whole village, starting off with the gimp who lives in the sewers. Hmm. And you basically
good place to start.
It's the weirdest game. Uh-huh. Oh, it was great.
I think that didn't come out here. Like back then during the PS2 era, like the weird import thing was kind of like a marketing tactic. Like, I remember what was the name? Ka the mosquito game.
Oh yeah.
We were like this mosquito that needs to go and like suck blood from people and stuff. I remember like for months reading about that in OPM, where it was just like, here's this game and it's gonna come to America and it's crazy, and it was like
that crazy Japanese.
And like, so that was such an interesting tactic for them to use.
There was Rule of Rose, which was a really horrible horror game. There were loads of PS2 horror games that never made it out of Japan. I think Rule of Rose may have made it to Europe. I don't know if it came to America. Really scary, had a dog in it, like you were adventuring with a dog, and nice. I thought, cool, a game with a dog. I bought this in Japan, and it was just the most horrible thing I'd ever played. I think after about 10 minutes, you're like locked into a coffin and children are urinating on you, and I was like, what is this? And then things like Gitaru Man, which did come out.
Yeah.
And, but I had a lot of like weird Japanese games on my PS2 that I was kind of proud to know about, you know. Sure, it was like a cred thing, and that just doesn't really happen now.
But now it's like there's such a the people who know about the cool independent game.
Oh, that's it. Yeah,
else the knows
the
about
indie
it.
Game.
Like, I don't like. There's so much shit on Steam that I'll be talking to people and they'll tell me about a game. I'll do podcasts with fans and I'll be listening. I'm like, oh great, what is that? Cool. And I'll click over to buy it because it sounds so awesome. And it came out in 2012. And I'm like, Jesus, you know what I mean? There's too many games now, which is great. That's what we need. But
there was a talk yesterday at GDC. There was a chart that came up showing how many games were applied. Given to the App Store for certification every day, and it's like thousands every single day.
That's insane.
So how are you supposed to keep track of that? My partner used to work at Pocket Gamer, which obviously is an iOS and Android and, you know, Pocket Things site, and you know, he was reviewing kind of 30 games a week in a roundup, and still barely, and that was years ago when there were like maybe 100 games a week,
sure.
not 1,000.
When
and now
it was
just
Levi Buchanan times, and you had a shot at knowing everything.
But right now it's like, I mean, there's no way anybody can know the mobile market. Right. Like, they can't know and it's the same with Steam. Like, there's hundreds a month on Steam, which is many, many fewer, but still too many to know.
Yeah, you can't play everyone having experience with it.
Yeah, I feel like nowadays with like Let's Plays and Twitch and all that stuff, like those are the games. Like your friend that like talked about all the obscure Japanese games and all that stuff. Like now you look at the top Twitchers and they're just playing these, or PewDiePie. PewDiePie's a perfect example. What the fuck games is he playing? Yeah, he plays Call of Duty, but then he also plays all these really, really weird.
He makes games. I mean, he makes games, not literally makes them, but makes them in the sense that
he made Flappy Bird take off, I think. You know, he did a video about that, and that sent it crazy.
But that's a perfect example. You know, like, where the fuck did Flappy Bird come
from? Skate 3. He was playing Skate 3 last year.
Uh-huh.
And they had to start reprinting the game in Europe.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah, I forgot about that story.
Because kids were wanting to buy it, and so they ended up reprinting Skate 3.
Damn.
See, that's crazy. Fucking awesome.
Yeah.
All right, going back to the release date conversation for a second. So, looking at this big list Game Informer has of 2015 video game releases. So, January, there's a ton, and Dying Light was kind of the standout. February, we got The Order, iDarb,
Helldivers.
Evolve, Helldivers, all this stuff.
Well, Helldivers technically today.
There was a big
February.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, okay, cool. I did not realize it was March.
So, there you go. Now we're in March, Helldivers.
Thank you.
And
La Mulana EX.
A million PS4 remasters, because that's going to happen forever. You know, and then you get into April, and so we start.
Hey, we had Monster. Nobody mentioned Monster Hunter. We had Monster Hunter.
Monster Hunter, we did.
And Majora's Mask on 3DS.
Yes. We need to talk about Monster Hunter.
You know, then we got.
I respect the Monster Hunter.
We got a lot of games coming. We're seeing the release dates and stuff. And then, obviously, since it's still a little early in the year, as you go on, there's very few dates that we actually have. Today we got a date for Final Fantasy X and X-2 on PS4. Mm. Then we got June 2nd, Arkham Knight. Dun, 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 dun. So that's like a big deal. August, we have nothing confirmed.
Isn't that E3 week? Why do people keep doing this?
Yeah, like, why is that? Well, hold on. Let's continue this.
There's got to be a reason.
Sorry, my bad.
Then the last one, then we got September. We got Mad Max and Metal Gear Solid 5. Nothing confirmed after that. So Arkham Knight on June 2nd, the week of E3, or the...
Are we sure it's E3?
No, it's not.
No, E3 is E3 in the middle of the month.
10th or, oh, is like it? 10th okay. or 15th.
Yeah, E3 is
they did it with Last of Us, and that's not like the... And there's other games they have
Didn't
done.
Didn't you end up
sure.
coming to E3 late because you were having to do Last of Us?
I left... Well, that was what I was doing before the Last of Us, and then I left that night or that early morning to get more shit done for it. Because I remember writing a story in the airport, because remember the Last of Us was broken when it came out.
Yeah.
And I was remember writing that up because everyone was freaking the fuck out. Like, you gave it a 10! And I'm like, it wasn't broken for me.
What game isn't broken when it comes out? No, this is like, what game isn't broken? And this is, you know, we'll presumably talk about this a little bit later, but this is a major reason why almost everyone now just doesn't review games until they're out.
Right.
Because there's
smart.
Too much now.
But like that's interesting, because there has been a couple other games. I can't think of them off the top of my head. But yeah, Last of Us, and there was other ones that I remember even being at IGN where we were like, shit, how are we going to cover this? We're all here doing this stuff.
Yeah, I remember Charles. What the hell was he reviewing during E3 once?
Bioshock? No.
No, it was... It's a game like that. Shit.
Sounds like Bioshock.
I remember Charles brought a game. Oh, no, I think it might have been Duke Nukem or something like that. I remember like when they finally released that you know, shitty Duke Nukem game.
Yeah.
I remember him bringing his Xbox 360 to E3 to play. I think it was for that game.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I mean, there are other
games. Other examples that we can't remember.
Yeah, now going back to that, though. So I think Arkham Knight is one of those games where it doesn't really fucking matter when it comes out. Like, they can avoid the holiday season because it's going to sell and, like, people are going to want that. Last of Us, it's pretty similar there. And even releasing during the E3 time kind of makes sense, just because then it's like, everyone's obviously going to be talking about it. So it's like, hey, here's the thing you could buy right now.
Yeah, you're
so
engaged.
That's cool. But then, yeah, going to September. September 1st for Metal Gear Solid 5. I feel like that might be one of the earliest AAA holiday releases we've ever got. Like, I remember Halo...
Usually it's late September onwards, isn't it?
Yeah, like Halo 3 was September 15th, I want to say, when it came out. And that was like, holy shit, like, you guys are going real early. But I remember there was some reason for that. It might have been a Gears of War or something else that they were trying to, like... separate from, or that was when Call of Duty was really kind of starting to kick ass. But that's insane. Like, how much earlier do you think they can get than that?
I mean, it's not how much earlier. It depends on what you think of the industry right now. And does it matter to be that close to holiday season? You know what I mean? A lot of times when you're pushing and going to holidays and doing all these things, like, you're trying to hit it so that your financials look right if you're that kind of company, right? And that's where these indie games step up, where it's like, fuck it. We'll release whatever we want, whenever we want to release it, and this is our time, and blah, blah, blah.
It doesn't
and it's amazing
have to fit into Q2 for our profit projections.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so for Konami and Kojima, I'm sure they want to shine. And so, like, it's like we could go and be the traditional holiday launch and come on to end of November or whatever, but why would we go to the end of October, beginning of November, when we can go to September and stand all alone for, hopefully, knock on wood, a month? You know, before there is another main contender to try to steal our limelight away. Especially if they believe in the game and it's going to come out and do, you know, nines and tens and whatnot.
People only have so much money, ultimately.
Exactly.
But it's interesting, like, when games come out that are just a little bit, you know, when you think, oh, this could have done with an extra few months.
Yeah.
It's almost always because whichever publisher it is, 2K or whoever, has to hit their Q2 financials projection, you know, and so it can't be delayed from March 1st to March 9th. It just can't, you know? Even the few days becomes a complete disaster.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, my reading the tea leaves totally on the outside, I know nothing about this, is like, this seems like the right time for Metal Gear. Let's not make any mistake. Konami, with the exception of Metal Gear and Pez, has nothing. So, like, they need this game to shine, you know? They need this game to do very well. Konami is, like, not the level of publisher that they used to be.
Certainly not.
But they have this game, and this game is going to be big because they killed Castlevania. So it's like, now you have Metal Gear, and ironically, they killed Castlevania after doing a really nice job with the original Lords of Shadow. No idea what they were thinking with that sequel. No idea what they were thinking with that 3DS game. No idea what they're thinking not making Metroidvania games annualized. This is the game that we've been waiting a long time for. When you think about Konami's IP and the studios that are working for them and the games that are coming out, I mean, this is it. So, like, it is a smart thing for them to avoid the fall. And the game might be done sooner than that, but maybe, you know, I think there might be something said about maybe not wanting to release your game in the summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was people a lot of rumors outside. About that. People, yeah. People were expecting it. So
it's one of those things. People aren't at their computers. Mm-hmm. You know, video games. What we do here on Twitch, it's all a distraction from you know, it's something to tune into, to be a part of. And so, yeah, if you're out living your life during the summer, you're a kid. You're not worried. If you're most kids, you're not worried. Like we were.
We were all nerdy children. Yeah. I presume we're all nerdy adults. Yeah. So like we're sitting there in July, like why are there no games? But you know, the vast majority of people are just out like climbing mountains, fishing. Going to space.
Yeah.
God.
You know.
Going to space.
Yeah. Here you are. They're out fishing. You're getting these, like, import bass games for the N64.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm fishing, too. I was just saying. She was saying, I'm fishing, too.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
I thought you were talking about fishing. What are your thoughts on fishing, Colin?
I don't have any thoughts on fishing.
Yeah,
no.
I can't imagine.
I never really thought much about it. No.
Really?
No. Again, another weird thing, because I'm from Long Island. And
you gotta get it, when you get there, you got to like Matt Noel when you do the Greg Miller documentary.
You had the sea, didn't you?
You had the sea.
Oh, no, I'm saying, the ironic thing is I'm from an island and I hate seafood.
Okay.
And that's like our big thing.
Oh, that's a shame. Because you know, like a lot of America genuinely doesn't have sea, so it makes sense that there'd be no fishing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, like, you know, fish in lakes and ponds, I guess. but nonetheless, yeah, I think this date makes sense for them. I think Mad Max is going to steal a little bit of their thunder. I think people that are into Mad Max are going to get that game. I have all the faith that Avalanche is making a good game with that. But yeah, this seems to make sense for, like, Konami needs the game to shine. And they need time to sell it, I think, too. Because it's a game that I think people are going to get excited about. It is not a word-of-mouth game necessarily because people like Metal Gear and they're going to buy Metal Gear.
Yeah.
But it might be a word-of-mouth game in the sense that some people have fallen off. And it has been a long time. Remember,
Metal Gear as well.
I'm sorry?
Might be Breakout Metal Gear.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's been 7 or 8 years since the last Metal Gear game, too. So people, I mean, the last core Metal Gear, not Peace Walker.
No, I know. But I'm just, I wasn't even offended. I just thought, and I was like, holy shit, yes.
Like, Metal Gear Solid 4 came out in 2008. So this is going to come out.
He's walking the ground zeros and all that.
Yeah. So it's a shrewd move, I think.
I think it's going to pay off. I think they're going to get
it. It does look so ridiculously good.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
September 1st, man. Can't come soon enough.
I skipped MGS4. I played 1, 2, 3, and then skipped 4. And
we can't even talk about this right now. We need to move on to the next topic, but my God.
I know.
I want to talk about that for a million.
I've been waiting for like a weekend for 8 years.
It's worth it.
Gotta put Bassmasters on there.
Yeah,
shit. Some important
next topic. Trading in video games. I want to hear your guys' stories about this. If you ever made any bad trade-ins, made any good trade-ins. The reason this comes up is because out of nowhere this week, GameStop. My bad.
Kevin and Ord's like, I'll allow you to trade your PS2 back to me.
They announced that you could release or you could trade in your PS2 for $25 if you also give all the AC adapter and
the accoutrements.
Yeah, and the DualShock 2, $25. If you don't have that stuff and you just have the PS2, you get $20.
Oh.
Which is like,
might as well just keep it.
Yeah. So first off,
don't trade your hardware.
Don't do that. That's a dumb decision.
Don't trade your hardware.
Second off, it's like, really? Like, you could sell the DualShock 2 for more than $5 on eBay. So it's
laziness.
That's dumb.
You couldn't.
But yeah, no.
No way.
Trust me, DualShock 2s are not. I mean, you cannot get them for cheaper than $5.
Just go on eBay.
Go for it.
Keep on.
I've tried for Let's Plays and stuff. Anyways, that just blew my mind. I don't know why they did this. This seems super random because they weren't accepting trade-ins for a while.
It's because they saw demand. It's the same thing that happened with those Wii games, like where Metroid Prime Trilogy and Xenoblade and like some other Last Story. I think like these games, like there was like this demand, this crazy demand where people were getting mad at GameStop for selling some of these used copies for a lot of money, and they're like, there is demand, like, and we are a company that makes money. So I think that when they shut off the PS2 spigot, as it were, like when it was like 2012, I think they were like, we're not taking anymore. It's probably because they had a shit ton of PS2s.
Yeah,
what are we gonna do with all these?
Yeah.
And then they were like, oh, we need more now, and so they're just replenishing the stock because there is a lot. We're all kind of old, and I think that we take for granted the fact that it's amazing to me, because I remember getting my PS2 when it came out, and like it was yesterday, but there are people that did not experience that console.
Yeah.
And well, so there's some interest in it.
And they're not bringing them to PlayStation now, so fuck it.
Also, like, I think there's a major thing, like, if you've got kids, right, and you don't necessarily have a ton of money, and you can't be affording to buy your kid a PS4 and every new game that comes out, you can buy 50 games for the PS2 with the amount of money you'd spend on like a year's worth of a year's worth of PS4.
Something I'd be really interested to see is the reason that the PS2 now has a resurgence because those games are really hard to play anywhere else. Like, you can't download the majority of those games.
Yeah,
you
the
know,
vast majority.
PS1 classics, those are a thing. You can download majority of the PS1 games in some form or another. But I think PS2 is way more of like you need those discs.
Yeah, you need the
majority of the PS2 games I would want to go back to, there is no way for me to play it because it's not backwards compatible and you can't download it and all this stuff.
I'm so glad I didn't trade in. all my PS2 games. I kept all of them.
Yeah, by that generation, I had smartened up because to your question, mm-hmm. I had a catastrophic, blunderous encounter at EB in 1997.
We've all been there.
And I wanted a PS1 so bad so I can play Final Fantasy VII. And it was the summer. It was before Final Fantasy VII even came out. And I traded most of my Super Nintendo games to get it.
Like, so, my heart's breaking right now.
So, and I had just an awesome SNES catalog. And I went back and bought them again later when I had more money. But it was like, that was so stupid. Yeah. You know, I wish someone was like, what are you doing? Like, the people at the store being like, why are you selling? We're giving you $10 for Final Fantasy III. We're giving you $12 for, you know, Chrono Trigger. We're giving you $8 for, you know, Robo Truck, whatever random ass games I had.
And then you're paying $60 to get it back five years later. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's like, Jesus, like, I'm glad I got my PS1 because that was really a game-changing moment for me. No pun intended. But I'll never forget that. I was like, why did I do this? Why did I do that? But I remember the rule being, I was so excited because they would give you no less than $5 for your games. That was like a rule there.
Things have changed.
And I had NHL 93, 94, 95, 96, 97, like Madden games, like all these data games. And I'm like, and I was making like a shit ton of money off of these, but then it would balance out by me getting nothing for these Squaresoft and these NX games made by Quintet and all these great defunct developers.
Sure.
Plus my first party games and stuff. So it was, I'll never forget that. That was terrible. And that really taught me my lesson because that was in eighth grade or me going in eighth grade. And by ninth grade, I had started going on eBay and collecting games again and like getting them all. And I never sold my NES games. Thank God I wasn't that stupid. But I started having to collect them again and how much money I lost because I already had them.
Yeah.
You know, man.
God, man, I have so many trading stories. Like, my life was trading in games to get new ones and stuff. And I made so many bad decisions. Like, I did that so many damn times. It's like, you'd think I'd learn, but I didn't.
But you had to do it. Yeah. I had the same thing. It was the way to stay current. There was no other way.
You were incredibly rich or your parents were.
Yeah, or your parents were. Yeah. My parents were like, I'm not buying this.
I got three games a year if I was lucky. I go one for my birthday, I go one for Christmas, and my brother go one for his birthday.
So
that was the deal. Yeah.
I think the best trade I ever made, and this is blasphemy to most people, but I had an extra copy of Pokemon Blue and Pokemon Red that someone like gave me at some point, and I traded it in for Star Wars Episode 1 Racer on the N64. But I had another one, so I was fine with that, and that was my favorite trade because I was like, I actually really enjoyed that game.
Right.
And I had a lot of fun with it, but I made some really bad decisions. I got a PS2 and I had no games because that was the deal. Mom was like, I'll get you the PS2, but like, you need to wait on the games. And it's like, well, that sucks. And I really wanted a game so badly that I traded into multiple N64 games for Crazy Taxi. Because it was one of the cheap PS2 games, just because I wanted it.
Oh, you played on PS2?
Yeah.
That's where I played, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I had the blue bottom. It's like not even a real PS2 game. It was one of those stupid CD ones.
Yeah.
It's like, come on. But yeah, I did that, and that was just such a stupid decision, and I immediately regretted.
Here's what I want to talk about, and I know I'm not among... You'll throw me to the fire. Was it really a bad decision?
Yeah, it was.
Why?
Because I'm like Colin. I go back, and I'm like... I've rebought so many of those games just because I like collecting these things.
I think I know what you're getting at, though. Like, these things can weigh you down if you have, like, 20 years worth of video games, like, clogging up. Mm-hmm. Like, in my house, I live with my partner who is 42 years old, and oh my god, so many video games. Yeah. Just boxes of, like, ancient computer shit. And it's all rubbish, mostly. And I'm like, seriously, can we pare that? Because I pared my collection down to, like, my best games, the ones I don't want to get rid of, and then I got rid of the rest. And I have, like, a nice... four shelf kind of thing. But from now on, like, I'd be quite happy from this day forward to never buy another physical game again. Quite happy to download
absolutely.
This. But with him, he's got like years and years and years and years and years worth, and he never traded anything in. He hoarded all of it, and I kind of get where you're coming from because it does start to
It's one of those things where you down. At our house, right, like I have the Metal Gear Solid on PlayStation 1, the double disc set. I have Spider-Man from Neversoft. I have like Genesis Spider-Man. Then I have like a bunch of different Ghostbuster ones, right? But most importantly, Ghostbusters on Sega Master System, which is this defining thing for me, and Ghost House and stuff like that. Like, these are sentimental things.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? But like, I traded in everything, and I know at my dad's house there's still a box somewhere that has all of my Master System games in it. No Master System. We sold that at a garage sale, but that's there. But my Genesis collection's gone. When N64 No Mercy reset on me on the third cart for like the seventh time, I traded it all in and got my PS1 and then traded that all in. For me, it was like, wiping the slate clean to go just because I never go back. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not somebody who's like, oh man, I really want to play Final Fantasy whatever today, or I want to play.
I am that guy. I love
that. That makes sense. It's just a different thing of like.
But you know, a lot of the time, like my games that I have now, they sit on the shelf for, you know, 9/10 of the year, but then very occasionally, like we do these Kotaku UK game nights now. In where I live in England, in Brighton, we do them in London as well, and we have games spanning the whole history of games there. So you know, we'll have like Sports Friends and Towerfall and PS4. But then I can bring like Amplitude, my PS2 version of Amplitude. I can just pluck that out and be like, we're setting that up over here. And you know, I've got my massive N64 collection, and I often put like something just random on in the corner, and people can explore that. And that's the time that I'm pleased that I've still got them. But a lot of the time, you know, I'm like, do I really need this copy of Red Faction Armageddon? Like, am I never going to play that again. So I agree with paring down.
Yeah, so that was the thing. So the PS2 era, like, to get my PS3, I had to trade in a ton of games, and I schemed the living shit out of GameStop, and it was awesome because I like piled deals on top of deals on top of deals, where it was like the 50% trade in, there was a bonus if you're this power member or whatever. I ended up like doing a really good deal. And I got my PS3 and Metal Gear Solid 4. But I did have to trade in like half my PS2 collection, and that was the first time where I was like, I'm not trading everything. So I kept my Amplitude, I kept my Final Fantasy X, I kept NBA Street Volume 2.
Of course.
Like these games that like meant something
to
me.
Sure. You were another of the 800 people that bought Amplitude.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Oh, man. The odds of this were so low.
Love Amplitude. But I kept those games because they meant something to me, but then there was a ton of other ones that I traded. And some of those I do regret now. Like I went back and I was like, I randomly want to play Onimusha 3.
Sure.
And it's just like, fuck, I don't have it.
The worst Onimusha game.
No.
The only one I ever truly rebought later was Spider-Man 2 on PS2. Because I played it, I'd done everything, and then I was like, whatever. And then I went out for a summer to an internship in D.C. And there, I would just come home on the weekends and like, there's nothing really to do or whatever. And I'd just be like, I kind of feel like just swinging around New York. Just like doing stuff. And like, that's what I would do. I went out, rebought it, came back, thinking Budweiser's in there, drink and swing.
Saying the scheme story right there, it reminded me of my ultimate video game scheme that I ever pulled off.
Yeah.
Was EB was doing a thing when the PSP came out where you can trade in three current gen games, which at the time was Xbox, GameCube, PS2, and you can get a PSP game. And I looked at the list, and I did a lot of research of what games you could trade in and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, what's the cheapest game you can possibly get to trade in? And, you know, obviously at that point, they wouldn't let you do what you did with, like, every sports game because, like, they just would give you nothing for it. And
they're,
like,
20, excludes, 20 cents.
Yeah, so it excluded everything. But I found out that Nine Shots Outlaw Golf Holiday Edition was the cheapest game you could get for $1, and they would let you do this. And I found the only place that sold it was a Blockbuster exclusive. So I went to every Blockbuster that was like anywhere in the area, and I bought every copy they had.
How many?
And oh, I mean, I don't remember, but it got to the point where I think at the end, I mean, I guess
are we like, talking dozens?
Or like six?
It was enough that I got every single PSP launch game. And ooh, I got so many PSP launch games extra that I traded those in to get the PSP.
Oh!
So for like $60, I got a PSP and all the launch games.
Damn, dude.
I had a good scheme.
Death Junior. Awesome.
I had a good scheme when the Dreamcast went, because I so my local game, which was EB in the UK, my local game was selling Dreamcasts for £20, which is nothing, and so basically I bought a bunch of Dreamcasts, like traded in Dreamcasts, and then the other place down the road was buying Dreamcasts for twice as much. So I traded in all these Dreamcasts again, and I got like four of them, and then I traded them on, I kept one. And then the other thing, which was the same year, was that they had a thing where they were getting rid of N64 stock, and so from their catalog, you could buy any N64 game for £5, which is nothing. And I went for like the rarest ones, and they had like four copies of Conker's Bad Fur Day left. And the same store was buying them for £25.
Same store?
Yeah. And awesome. I literally went to the store to pick up these four copies of Conker's Bad Fur Day, picked them up, went, thank you very much, and then just went to the counter and was like, I'd like to trade three of these in, please, for £60. It was great.
Damn.
That is
good scheme. Awesome.
That's a good scheme.
The schemiest one I ever did, and it was dirty and filthy, and I shouldn't have done it. But in Colombia, I had my PS2, and like I'd already bought it. I had my PS2, and it was failing. It was dying or whatever. The disk drive was dying. And so it only read the blue bottom things because I had a copy of The Sims.
That happened to me.
So what I did is I took it to the Tiger Pawn, the pawn store. I was like, hey, I want to pawn this PS2 in this game. And they tested it with that game.
And it worked.
Works great. And took it. And I was like, I'm so
that happened to me. I couldn't play God of War on my PS2.
Yeah.
No, God of War 2. By the time that game, it just wouldn't read.
Yeah.
There was this thing you could do to make your PS2 region free without chipping it, which was like, I can't remember what it was called, but it was a stupid piece of plastic with a hook on the end, and you had to
pull out the disc tray.
You had to jimmy the front off the disc tray and then put this bit of plastic and just root around in there.
Magic Gate.
Yeah, that's Magic.
For us, it was Magic called Magic Gate.
And you'd pull it out. Like, this is how I played Guitar Hero, because Guitar Hero didn't come out for ages in Europe, and it was my favorite game of ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally ruined my PS2 doing that. Just jamming, drunk, trying to play Guitar Hero. Just move it around a bit. Pull it out. And my PS2 didn't last very long.
Yeah, it's funny that the shady shit you had to do to your consoles to get them to play the games you wanted them to play. I still remember getting this thing on PS1. I don't remember the name of it, but it was like a thing you put in the back port, and then you had to take a spring and put it onto the hook so that you can leave your lid open. Then you had to put
you could use a matchstick, couldn't you, for the PS1?
I guess the whole thing was to make the lid stay open so that you could read an American disc. And then when it started the PS1 thing, you would take it out and put in the European or Japanese disc. And then it would just continue as if it had already read the thing or whatever. I'm like, it's so weird.
I think you could do that with a matchstick. I seem to remember propping up various bits of console with matchstick. I can't remember if it was Dreamcast or PS1 or what.
So it's so weird. The good news is that you really don't have to do that shit to play the games you want to play.
These are all stories everyone watching is like, God, tell us about the war or something, old people. God, with your matchstick.
Whatever. Oh, but I just want to say really quick, just as distressing as that Super Nintendo to PlayStation story was, I didn't understand that CDs could not save. You couldn't save your game on CD.
Oh, man.
And I remember being all set up, and Final Fantasy VII came out, and I was like, why can't I save my game?
Oh, man.
And it was like, I needed a fucking memory card. And I was like, I have no money left. I have no games to trade left. And I remember begging my parents, being like, listen, guys,
I made an error.
I can't, I went through this whole fucking ordeal and I can't play this game now. I need a memory card.
That's such a tragedy.
And I was like, oh,
did they buy it for you?
Yeah. They did. But it was the bootleg one, not the PlayStation one.
My first PlayStation one had a fucking giant basketball on it. I'm like, god damn, like a 3D basketball.
My PS1 one was the blue EA Sports one. The guy had to be like, no, it's from Mad Catz, but it will save your game. You sure? All right.
God, remember all those junky third-party controllers used to be just terrible, with a turbo button.
Yeah. There's always a turbo button. And it only helped in Final Fantasy X getting Lulu's special weapon. Anyways, final topic for the show.
Yeah.
Is traditional game journalism dead? Now, I bring this up because I think this is a very interesting group of people to talk about.
Sure,
this.
Yeah.
We got us. We left IGN to essentially, we left traditional games journalism to do fucking this crazy weird internet video thing. Then you left IGN to do a different form of games journalism.
Yep. So I think, yes, traditional games journalism is dead, as in the journalism that we grew up with in the 90s and 2000s.
Yep.
It's gone. Because the purpose of the magazines I used to buy and the early websites I used to read, the purpose of those was to tell me stuff about games. Give me information, give me screenshots, give me this game's coming out.
What did it feel like?
And now, people can get that information however they want. They can get it from PS Blog, they can get it from YouTube, they can get it wherever. Being the gatekeepers to information is no longer a viable thing. So that version of the games press is gone. But I think what's come up in its place is much more interesting and varied. People still have this thing where they think of the whole of the games media as journalism. About 20% of it is journalism. The rest is entertainment, criticism, all this other really interesting stuff that we do now. And, my job, about half of my job is reporting. And then the rest of it is criticism and entertainment. And, what a lot of people do on YouTube is essentially games entertainment. It's like a TV show about games.
Yep.
And that's fine. That can coexist. And there's this weird perception that, the games media is dying. And it's not. It's just diversifying. And it's become a bigger thing. Games journalism is now only a part of the games media, which is a much bigger thing. But I think it's a really interesting time to be involved in talking about games. I've been doing this for 10 years. I started off on a magazine when I was 17 years old. And I wrote... I remember the first thing I was asked to do, I won't name the magazine, I was asked to write a preview of Okami, And I was like, I haven't played Okami. I've never even seen it. And they were like, just go look at it on GameSpot and then rate it from that. That was genuinely what we had to do on that magazine. And that was, you know, that's what print was at. That's the stage that print was at that point, you know. And I left print after a year because although I liked having like a magazine in my hands that I'd written because that was exciting, I just realized that, you know, most of the companies who had, you know, print magazines, they weren't looking at the internet. And meanwhile, I'd grown up internet.
Yeah.
I had my own website when I was a teenager, you know, and I read a lot of IGN and Eurogamer
and
a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I went into online after that. And I did, you know, I worked with Eurogamer and a bunch of other websites for a long time before I joined IGN and now at Kotaku. And even in that time, like, it just changes every year. Every year it changes. And, like, at IGN, it was very much like a combination of, you know, I don't want to say marketing, but, like, publisher-driven, here's a thing we want you to show your audience stuff, and then entertainment, and then like criticism and reviews. And at Kotaku, it's different again. Like, a lot of what we do is post-release, so it's like, and I do a lot more reporting, I do a lot more investigating of things because we don't do previews at all. And again, like, a lot of sites now don't do previews, for instance. It's becoming old-fashioned, and a lot of people aren't doing scored reviews anymore, you know, one by one. So I don't think IGN will ever give up scores, and I don't think they necessarily should, but a lot of other sites have been giving up scores for years. So again, like, if I were to say, is the games journalism that I started doing when I was 17 dead? Pretty much, or it's on the way. But the thing I'm doing now is a different thing, and I think it's more interesting.
And it's in the same wheelhouse. That's the thing, is everything's just evolving and changing. It's what I've been saying to people for years. You know, I remember 4 PAXs ago, there was a panel that was basically like, independent game site, can you compete with IGN, GameSpot? And, you know, and the answer, and I read it and I went to the panel and I was like, the answer is no. You shouldn't try to. You should do something different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You should be driving people to you in a different way. And that's why previews are falling off and scores are falling off, because do you want to be one of the 36 sites that are like, this game's a 9.5? I don't know. Like, figure out a better way to talk about games and the way people want to hear you talk about games.
Yeah,
right? Like,
entirely.
Colin, I don't need to score something for, you know, if we like it.
Everyone knows I hate scores too, and I agree with what Keza was saying. Like, people conflate games media with games journalism.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what Keza does is journalism. I think that a lot of what I did, but not all of what I did, was journalism. You know, for all the people that call us or called us journalists in quotes, it's like, go read my 50,000 word history of Naughty Dog and tell me that's not journalism.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, there are things that, like, we're doing that is journalism, but we do have to separate what is a real journalist that does the White House beat for Washington Post doing compared to, like, us playing and talking about video games. They're very different, you know?
I think it works the other way, too, where I feel like a lot of people refer to me as a games journalist, and I'm like, no, at no point was I ever that. I am a game entertainer.
But
you saying that, it's like, that's what I am.
Like, I mean, and sometimes, like you say, one of the Twitter insults or comments insults, you go, call this journalism, and it's like, no, it's not. This particular thing isn't journalism.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Now and then I'll do the thing that's like, yeah, that's journalism. Like, I mean, every site I've ever worked for has had, you know, a bunch of people who hate it. I think every big site has a bunch of people who hate it. And the criticism we always used to get at IGN is, it's not journalism. It's like, well, does it have to be?
Yeah.
Really? Because that's very limiting, actually. If the only thing you're allowed to do is journalism, you're not allowed to do any opinion, and you're not allowed to do any entertainment, and you're not allowed to do any criticism. It's just like, come on. There's loads of more interesting things to do.
It's one of those words people throw around, and I think they understand the weight of the word journalism or what it truly means. You know what I mean? When I got my degree in journalism from the University of Missouri and came to IGN after working in a daily newspaper where I was like, we were super ethically driven, everything I'm writing is super just, this side said this and this side said that, and it's not about what I think either side means, you know what I mean?
Totally.
To get there on day one, write my first review and turn to Rob and be like, hey, I wrote this review, you want to read? And he's like, nah, just publish it. And I was like, what, excuse me?
Oh my God, the internet
is great.
And he's
like, just publish it. And I'm like, don't you want to proofread? He's like, have you looked it over? I'm like, yeah. He's like, it's fine then. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Man, early
internet
was so like that.
Exactly.
Like, there weren't any editors. I mean, actually, I think one of the greatest tragedies of the loss of print media is the loss of sub-editors. Like, those people that used to just, their whole job was to craft things and make them, like, look good on the page and fix all your grammar and make it consistent with everything else that was on the website. Like, we've lost sub-editors, basically. And it's a shame. It's a loss of a craft that I think was important to writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got away from calling our journalists really early on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's what I always talk about in the story I was telling when I was working in the daily newspaper, is, you know, going to cover this congressman's meeting, and it was a boiling hot Missouri day, and I got there, and I'd walk there like an idiot, and I was sweating like a moron, and I drank this bottle of water, and I put it down empty, and I went, oh, my God. I just... I just totally sacrificed my ethics. I drank the water they paid for. I went to his aid and I was trying to pay her for the bottle of water I just drank. And she's like, get the fuck out of here. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. It's not a big deal. And
I had to sacrificed
go
and, my ethics.
I had to go tell my editor. And he's like, it's not a big deal. Don't worry, blah, blah. And then you get to IGN and games journalism in quotes at the time where it's like, oh, here's this all-expensed four-day trip to go see two games. Like, you're going to be gone for like 72 hours and you're going to see two games for 15 minutes apiece. Yeah. And then the rest is just drinking with your friends and partying at this pool. You're like, what the fuck is happening?
But that's entertaining. Like, I mean, the thing is, that doesn't happen so much now. As
it's a different world.
Yeah, because I mean, apart from anything else, nobody's got the money to do it. Like, we don't, in the early 2000s, like when I started out in mid-2000s, like people just had all this money. Like Vivendi would just have all this fucking money. And they'd just be like, hey, just take people to Miami for a week to show them three games. And it was just ridiculous. Yeah. But the thing is, it's still like that in like lifestyle and entertainment journalism, which isn't journalism in the same way as what we do.
Call it?
But you know, I remember reading a thing. A friend of mine who works in entertainment journalism wrote that was a review of Virgin Flights' entertainment system. And then at the bottom it was like, thanks to Virgin for the 3-day trip to a Jamaican spa.
Yeah.
You know? And it was like, I mean, that stuff still happens. And it's like, nobody has a go at somebody writing for a lifestyle or entertainment website for going on a trip or for all this stuff, because no one expects journalism from them.
Yeah.
And I think there's a weird thing in games where people expect everything to be journalism all the time. And it's like, where did this come from? Because it never even was like that. Like, when I was reading magazines growing up, like, very little of that was journalism. Most of it was just messing around.
Yeah.
And so I think it's always just the fear, right? Like, and it's the, again, I think the games industry is so young that, you know, we're still learning all this as we go and still seeing it develop and all these different things. And it comes down to basically people being afraid of, oh, IGN got paid off to give that a 10 and I'm not going to.
Which never happens, incidentally. Yeah. Literally in 10 years, I've never heard of that happening in the specialist press.
That's the really frustrating thing, is like, for all the conspiracy theories that are out there, like, I don't even know what anyone's talking about.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe those things have happened at other places at other times. I have no idea. All I know is that in my experience with my outlet that I worked at and like the people surrounding me, everything was on the up and up.
I worked for pretty much every British games outlet now. Never once. Mm. And like, interestingly, the conspiracy theory things become worse lately because there's this concept of internet truth, which is that something just becomes received wisdom on whatever forum or Twitter or whatever. It just becomes received wisdom, and at no point has anybody ever proven it.
Yeah.
And then those same people are like, you're not doing journalism. So you're not even doing thinking correctly. You're not doing evidence-based thinking.
Yeah, I mean, that was the funny thing to me, was that like, there are even I've seen a few posts and a few tweets being like, you know, games journalism is getting cleaned up, and one of them is that IGN fired Colin Moriarty and Greg Miller or whatever. And really? I'm like, really? Because I'm pretty sure we quit 3 months before we left, and there were all, you know, there were attempts to keep us there and all these kinds of things. It's just like, but like, you're right. Like, once it's out there, it's out there, and it
internet
is what
truth,
it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. But I do sympathize with what some people say about games, let's call it games writing, right? Mm-hmm. I do sympathize. I think a lot of, like, I think some games writing is complete trash. I think that a lot of it is click driven and that's something that I really never cared about personally. I got traffic because I wrote about the things I cared about and I was passionate about those subject matter. That subject matter.
Not everybody's that lucky.
No, I know that. Mm. But you know, I understand why people are mad about clicking on a story about rehashing the same thing over and over again, or just not letting
a certain subject go. Those horrible headlines, you know, because there are some. You know, part of the reason for this, and I think the biggest problem that games media has, is that everybody who gets good goes away because the money's poor, usually. Unless you're really lucky, the money's poor in games journalism. The career prospects are low. Like, once you get to, you know, senior editor,
you hit the ceiling. Yeah, like, well, where do I go from here?
Yeah, you know, I don't know what I'm doing in 10 years. Like, am I still going to be editing a website?
Yeah.
I don't know. And all these reasons, and you know, there's little respect associated with the profession outside of the gaming world. And for all these reasons, like, people get to 30, they get really good, and then they go and they just hire like wave after wave of young people who don't necessarily know how to do good reporting, and they've got no one training them. And meanwhile, a lot of media organizations aren't investing properly in training their staff. So that's why you get a lot of rubbishy headlines, and that's why you get a lot of really just bad reporting, because nobody's trained young people
to do it. You see the
same
mistakes over and over.
Yeah, and it's kind of frustrating, because I think that, you know, if you want to fix games journalism, then show me the money. Put some money into it, train people, give people who are, you know, 30 plus and who've been doing this for a long time good incentive to stick around, and you're going to have a better quality of journalism. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the outlets that do value their writers consequently have a better level of writing.
Yeah,
and, you know,
I totally agree with that, just in the sense that there is a lot of churn, which creates, ironically, a lot of churnalism, which then, you know, like, it is important to compartmentalize what the different kinds of things people are doing out there and the different kinds of writing that are out there. For instance, you're one of the, like, and I've said it when you left IGN, I was like, I can't believe that like we're losing Keza, because Keza's like one of the great writers in games, and you are, you know.
Thank you, man.
I think that, you know, one of your colleagues in the States, Jason Schreier, is another one of these guys that writes real journalism.
He is,
you know,
such a good reporter.
And
it's
like
crazy.
and I have a lot of respect for him. Guys like Matt Leone over at Polygon write real journalism. If you want that kind of stuff, and I feel like I used to write that kind of stuff too, and I still do. I like more editorializing now, so I'm not like researching anymore, but you have to, if you want that kind of stuff, support that kind of stuff, but understand that things are kind of changing, and that there's always going to be a place for that kind of great writing and that essential kind of writing, but people are going over to YouTube and people are moving over to Twitch and finding the people that they trust in games criticism, which must be compartmentalized from games journalism, which is why I think games criticism is kind of falling.
Yeah.
And I think that games journalism is kind of plateaued, where it's like there are good people out there doing good work and I support them, and the stories behind the games are the best. It's the best, you know? So you have to, if you want to see more of it, make sure to support the people that are doing it right now, because you'll see more of it if you do.
And then there's also another thing I sympathize with when people, because someone criticizing Kotaku with, you know, on Twitter with me recently was like, oh, you just put up, there's a lot of like really valueless stuff that you put up, and it's just like, just to fund people like Jason and you and Patrick Kopeck and whoever else they picked who were good. And it's like, well, yeah, that's kind of how online media works. There's always going to be stuff on the site that's not the best, or there's always going to be something that's, even if it's not a mistake, if it's just like a low value, like, oh, here's a video that's cool, you know, or oh, here's a picture someone's done, there's always going to be three line stories, because unfortunately that's kind of the way the online media works now. Like, you
it's
need
the
volume. You can't make every single thing you put up on the internet take you 3 days of research, right? Because you it's just not viable as a business. So when you read a site like, I mean, BuzzFeed is another example, you know, a lot of just like quite valueless trash that might make you smile, but you know. And then a lot of interesting investigative journalism. It took a long time. You know, that's kind of how the ratio works. I think a lot of people criticize, you know, whether it's IGN or Kotaku or anyone, there's a lot of criticism like, oh, but so much of what you do, like, you haven't put much effort into, and it seems like, you know,
it's a top 10 list.
It's a list. It's like, well, that's what you have to, well, that's why we get to do good things. It's because these things go up and they're less effort and they do good business. And that's, you just got to be, it's business minded about it. You know?
And that's the piece of the puzzle that always bothered me the most, is that people be like, I hate, would go into the comments of a story and be like, I hate this kind of writing. I'm like, but you are clicking on it. And that is and that is sending the metric message that you like it. If you don't, that's another thing. If you don't want to see the stuff you don't want to see, do not consume it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because then the numbers will plummet and you'll get more of something else. You
well,
know, in
one of the things I like about working at Kotaku is I think the ratio is pretty good. Like almost everything I work on, I get to spend time on and I really enjoy. And interestingly, the stuff that is best for us, at least on my UK bit of the site, the stuff that does best for us is usually the stuff that took a lot of effort. So it makes sense, and it's great because that gives you the opportunity to spend time on interesting features and not necessarily, you know, thankfully we're big enough that we don't have to shit out 20 shit stories a day. Like if you're a small site and you just have to get volume and you're just trying to get on GAF and M4G and stuff, and you're just these poor young guys are just shitting out 20 rubbish stories a day, you know. We don't have to do that where I am, and I feel very lucky not to have to do that. But unfortunately, that is kind of the model for online journalism because of the way that the advertising model works. And this is why I think that the online advertising model, this is very boring. I won't go on about it, but I think it's definitely going down the toilet. Like the way that ads work, like based on volume, like, oh, there's X thousand people, X million people read this, therefore the ad is worth this much. I think that's definitely dying.
It's all changing.
Yeah.
The entire thing is changing. And it's changing thanks to you guys for supporting us in places like patreon.com/kindoffunnygames.
This is
thank
amazing,
so
by the way.
Much.
I think what you've
it
done
is
fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you very
it's
much.
Really
thank
great.
You very
I very, much. Very much enjoyed what you've been doing.
Thank, yeah. thank you. We appreciate that. That means a lot from you.
This has been the first ever and last ever episode 10 of the Kind of Funny Games cast. Thank you so much, Keza, for joining us.
No worries.
Thank you
been
so
a
much to the people on Twitch watching us live. That was super cool of you. Your chat was great, I'm sure. I didn't see it, though.
We're not allowed to.
Yeah.
Kevin won't allow it.
Kevin's being kind of a mean guy right now. Anyways, thank you so much. We'll see you next week. I love you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.